Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Stephen Ovitzky. He is the executive director of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, which just opened this weekend. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure.
So, as always, and now what, in its 39th year, is that
39th
correct?
39th season, yeah.
You are directing an almost unimaginably vast and certainly keeping you busy selection of music from all over the country, all over the world. What's this festival about this year? What are some of the highlights?
Well, as Mark Nykrug, our artistic director, would say, every day is a highlight. But the festival is so broadly based that there's not one particular focus any given year. And when you have over 40 concerts in a 5.5 week period and about 80 musicians and about 100 different pieces of music, there's just, you can put together patterns in so many different ways because there's so many pieces of music, from Baroque music to world premieres to everything in between, music of all different periods, all different styles, all different national origins, even some jazz, bluegrass, gypsy, and tango music. So it's
bluegrass?
Time for Three. It's a group made up of three fantastic string players. In fact, the violinist or fiddle player in the group is the concertmaster of the Indianapolis Symphony. And he finds time to work with this group. They are so amazing. On the Friday of Indian Market on the 19th of August at 8 o'clock at the Lensic, they're going to be performing their remarkable mix of just all kinds of eclectic music. They do everything from Leonard Cohen songs in arrangements that are so amazing to Orange Blossom Special and everything in between. It's going to be a knockout concert of great playing.
Extraordinary. So talk about some of the world premieres.
Well, we have a few world premieres. As always, the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival is known throughout the world as being one of the important creators of new chamber music. And this year, Christopher Rouse, the American composer, will be here as the Calder String Quartet performs his new String Quartet number 3 that was just co-commissioned by us with a few other organizations. And that will be on noon on the 28th of July, and then again on Friday evening the 29th. And at 5 p.m. at St. Francis Auditorium, Chris Rouse will be giving a pre-concert talk about his music. And then we have a young American composer named Sean Shepard, who has written a piece for oboe and three strings that will be played by Liang Wang, who's the solo oboist of the New York Philharmonic. And that will be on Thursday the 11th of August at noon over at St. Francis Auditorium. And then again on Friday the 12th of August at St. Francis at 6 o'clock. And Sean will be talking with Mark Nykrug at 5 o'clock before the concert.
Does oboe quartet mean four oboes?
No, it means oboe and violin, viola, and cello.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I once did go to a tuba quartet, which was four tubas.
Right. Yeah, that was one of our new summer ticket people said, are there really going to be four oboes there? I said, no, it's Mozart right. wrote an oboe quartet also for the same combination.
So when somebody is writing an oboe quartet and they're on some level using the same instrumentation as Mozart, they're writing a chamber music piece, for the example, this Sean Shepard piece, do you hear influence of Mozart, of the predecessors in that instrumental configuration?
I don't know, because we haven't heard the
piece
yet. It's a premiere.
Of course.
We commissioned him along with the La Jolla Music Festival, and we've not heard it yet. In fact, the music was just delivered to the players about 2 weeks ago.
Ah.
So the first time I hear it in a rehearsal will be the first time I hear it.
So let's talk for a moment about the players. Are these folks who tend to play together, or are you getting individual players from all over the place and they have to play together?
We do both. We engage some of the finest instrumentalists in the world to come to the festival, and while they're here, we assemble them into ensembles. But at the same time, we also bring in a number of string quartets and a few existing groups of the Calder Quartet, the Ohana String Quartet. But for example, the Ohana String Quartet, Suvin Kim is the first violin. He has a solo career. C.J. Chung, the violist, is the principal violist of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Peter Stumpf, the cellist, is principal cellist of the L.A. Philharmonic. And they get together at certain times of the year to have the Ohana String Quartet. On the other hand, the Shanghai Quartet, who is here right now, this week, they are a full-time string quartet. Their entire career is built on working together, playing together. They teach at the same university where they're in residence. So there's different kinds of quartets. The Orion Quartet, all those players have careers in the quartet and as soloists, and they will be here for about a week also. But our festival...
They were here a couple of years ago.
They're here every year.
Oh, they're here
wonderful.
Every year, okay.
They're one of the top quartets in the world. And one of the things that we do is we prefer bringing in great musicians so they can interact with each other in ensembles that Mark puts together for them. And that's the way our festival and Chamber Music Northwest up in Portland tend to operate.
We're talking to Stephen Ovitzky of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. It must be nice, not only for audiences who go every year, or maybe who are trying for the first year to go to the Chamber Music Festival, but for the musicians themselves to come to Santa Fe and experience this and the kind of getting to play together that you're talking about.
They love it. I mean, many of our musicians have been here multiple times. We try to mix the idea of having regulars that come here and new people. And this year we have quite a few new people who will be coming to the festival for the first time. And in many cases, they come back a year or two later. And that's it's that mix of someone coming in and working with people who have been here before and that old and new and new musicians who are new on the circuit playing with veterans. It's a great experience for everyone.
Let's talk for a moment about Claudio Ragazzi.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hear a piece of music by him and then maybe something else in a moment that he plays on.
Well, Claudio Ragazzi is an Argentine guitarist. And he's going to be here playing in Osvaldo Golijov's Aire with Don Upshaw.
Now, what is
that's
this
piece? It's a full half of a concert piece that Golijov wrote for Don Upshaw. And that's going to be performed on the 31st of July and the 1st of August over at St. Francis Auditorium, both concerts at 6 p.m. And it's for Dawn plus an ensemble of about 8 or 10 musicians, including guitar, accordion, some electronics, and assorted other things. And we all felt that it was best to get the musicians who were in the original production of this. And so Ragazzi is coming along with Michael Ward Bergman, who's a great accordion player. He has this thing he calls the hyper accordion. And Mark Dresser, the jazz bass player, will be in that also. And Mark Nykrug thought that as long as they were going to be here for concerts on Sunday and Monday, the three of them play together regularly. And they can do a concert of South American music, tangos, Brazilian music. They can do that on Saturday. And so at 8 o'clock on Saturday, July 30th at St. Francis Auditorium, they'll be doing a concert just with the three of them. So it's guitar, accordion, and bass. And we have a recording of a piece with the three of them playing called La Boca.
Well, let's listen to that right now. Thank you. and we were just listening to the playing of Claudio Ragazzi on the piece La Bocca, which is, Claudio will be here as part of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. We're talking to Steven Ovitzky. So I really appreciate the way you have so many different genres of music as well as styles of music.
Well, that's part of the festival. Yeah. That's why it's a festival. And I'm really looking forward to that concert because I love great tango accordion playing.
Yeah.
And Michael Ward Bergman, who you heard on that, is fantastic. And I will give the number so people can call. It's going to be a great concert in another week and a half. And that's 982-1890. And our wonderful box office team will take care of getting you great tickets.
And there are also, for those who want to go to, well, first of all, you can subscribe. Can you still subscribe?
Yeah, I mean, we're in our first week right now.
Yeah.
If people want to subscribe, we can arrange for that. We have a thing called a Six Pass, which gives you a discount on six tickets for concerts of your choice, or if you and five of your friends can use it for one concert.
Right.
Any combination of six. And that's a very popular option for people, especially after the season has begun.
And people can also go to dress rehearsals.
They can go,
open
rehearsals. We have quite a few open rehearsals throughout the year. Those are free. And we also have noon concerts twice a week. And the noon concerts are very low priced. And again, our ticket office people can tell you all about those. But we were talking about Ragazzi and Michael Ward Bergman and Mark Dresser. They're performing on Osvaldo Golihov's Aire.
Now let's stop for a moment and identify Osvaldo Golihov to those who don't know who he is.
Argentine-born composer. He
still went, living.
Yeah, young man. He went to study in Israel. He came back to the U.S. He's teaching in the New England area now. And he's written so much music that has been performed by orchestras and ensembles. The opera here in Santa Fe did an opera of his a few years ago that Dawn Upshaw was in. He loves Dawn singing, and she's our artist in residence this year.
Right.
So she wanted to do this piece, and it's fantastic. It's based on all kinds of old poetry, some Sephardic poetry in Judeo-Spanish, some Middle Eastern poetry, just a whole range of things. And as I mentioned, it has some orchestral instruments, but also accordion and guitar, and some sound-altering electronics. It's going to be a really great concert, and in fact, the Sunday performance on July 31st is virtually sold out, but there are some very good tickets left for the Monday performance.
Ah, okay.
And this is, I would say, this is a concert absolutely not to be missed. And Dawn is such a wonderful soprano, and Golihov just knows how to write for her voice, and she knows just how to sing his music. I mean, she's a perfect interpreter of his music.
I think we forget that all composers probably did that. Mozart and
everyone else
wrote for their favorite vocalists and instrumentalists, and now that they're gone, we don't even know what that sounded like, and here we are with access to that beautiful marriage of the composer and the vocalist.
And the performers. Yeah. And that's part of the way all music has been composed. A very little music is composed in an abstract, I mean, at least by composers who get performed. Certainly composers that don't get performed might write pieces in the abstract, but most composers are writing now for commissions for ensembles or individuals or orchestras that they know, and they've been engaged to create a piece for a certain group. And that was the case with Golihov. He wanted to do this thing for Dawn, and turned out a masterpiece.
Should we listen to a little
bit
of it right now?
Sure, just a little bit. We have one short aria from that.
All right, here we go.
Las cintas de tu cabello y la falda, y devoremos la noche hasta el alba, así muchachita descansa. Necesitamos cielo, si vos tede sa mia spada, e io la luna in la sada, assi angi, tu cintura de plata, si mañana in el pueblo te risuona e spera, no digas el secreto en que me llevas, así angi junco flor miel y
And we were just listening to Dawn Upshaw, and the piece was called Suéltate las cintas, Untie Your Ribbons,
right,
by Osvaldo Golijov.
Right. And it's from Aire, which is, it takes up the entire half of a concert. And on that same program, we'll have Schubert's great string quartet based on his song Death and the Maiden.
Ah.
And with the Johannes Quartet, they're a remarkable string quartet. It's going to be, when you have a great work of Schubert and then a great modern work of Golijov, that is what the festival is about. Classics and modern classics and new discoveries, that pieces that you may have never heard, or composers you may never have heard of, but music that's so engaging and so memorable that you're wondering, why haven't I ever heard of this guy?
Right.
And we have some music by a composer named Mieczysław Weinberg, a piano trio coming up later in the season. Weinberg escaped the Nazis. He was from Poland, escaped the Nazis. And unlike some Eastern European composers who came to the United States or to England, he went to Moscow and lived under the shadow of Shostakovich and Prokofiev for many years. And finally, his music is starting to get really played much more often. It's very original, very, very solid and beautiful. And last year we did a piece of his. Mark found another piece, and until I heard a recording of it a couple months ago, I'd never heard the piece, and I knew a lot of the Weinberg symphonic music, but this is a fantastic piano trio. And
when's that?
That's on Monday, August 15th, at the Lenzik.
So, ladies and gentlemen, cancel all your plans.
Right, every night.
Every time you come every year, and every year I think I've just got to cancel everything so I can go to all of these things you're talking about. What a privilege for Santa Fe.
It's a great festival, and we're known internationally. We have a nationally syndicated radio program that's produced in Chicago and distributed to about 200 radio stations around the country, and I understand that KSFR will be carrying the program in the fall.
Excellent.
Which is going to be great. It's been on KHFM in Albuquerque, the classical station, and we're glad to get another playing of it here. But our series has been broadcast by the BBC and by foreign radio services all over the world, and it gets the message out about Santa Fe because so many of the musicians love it so much here. When they're interviewed on the radio program, they talk about how much they enjoy being here and
right. What
their favorite things are in Santa Fe. So it's promotion for our wonderful town, and it's a great way for people to hear the special kind of music making that happens at the festival.
Tell us some of the venues that you'll be in. Often St. Francis Auditorium.
St. Francis Auditorium is the main hall. And that's at the New Mexico Museum of Art on West Palace Avenue, right at the plaza.
And what a nice room that
is. It's gorgeous. The sound's lovely. The ambience is really Santa Fe. The courtyard for the intermission is fantastic. And then for some of our concerts, the last week and a half or so, we're at the Lenzik, another spectacular location. And then we have three concerts in Albuquerque. The first three Wednesdays of the season at Sims Auditorium at the Albuquerque Academy.
Uh-huh. Stephen Ovitzky, anything else before we go?
Just a couple things. As we've discussed, there's so much music on the festival that the best thing to do is to get a schedule. And you can do that by calling 982-1890, or you can stop by our ticket office at the New Mexico Museum of Art. That's open, the hours that the museum is open. Or you can go to our website at www.santafechambermusic.com.
SantaFeChamberMusic.com. Steve Novitzky is executive director of this wonderful annual festival, and I'm sure there'll be a very big deal next year when you have your 40th anniversary.
We already have, if you come to the concerts, you'll get an advance brochure about the amazing programs for next year.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for being with us and for bringing music today.
It's a pleasure.
I'm happy now to welcome to the program Shelby Tisdale. She is the director of the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture and the Laboratory of Anthropology, and she's the editor of the new book, Spider Woman's Gift, 19th Century Diné Textiles. And this Sunday, the 24th of July, at 2 o'clock, there will be a discussion and book signing about this new book at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. Welcome to the Radio Café.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. It's been a while.
It has been a while.
Yeah.
We need you to come on the program more often.
I think so. Well, thank you for inviting me today. I
no,
really appreciate
my pleasure.
It.
I mean, this is an unusual thing. It's basically a catalog for an exhibition that happened in the past, and there was so much demand for a book that you decided to put one out after the fact.
That's correct. The exhibit was in 2006, and, of course, the exhibition and the book are both based on our permanent collections. So these are all textiles that are in our collection at the museum. And we have a lot more. It was kind of tough trying to decide which ones to put in the exhibit because we had some wonderful examples of this particular time period, the 19th century.
So tell us about the title, Spider Woman's Gift. Who is Spider Woman?
Spider Woman is, according to Navajo legends, stories, their own perspective of their history, Spider Woman is the one who taught them to weave. And she originally taught them to weave baskets. And then the basket weaving then moved into woolen textiles that we know more of today.
And there is symbolism. And this is one of the things I love about reading books about art history, because you look at something 5 million times and then somebody tells you, oh, that's the symbolism of the spider, and you see it completely as
totally,
if for the first time.
Totally different, absolutely. And that's what's so wonderful about the book, is that the section that was written by Joyce Begay Foss, who is our director of education at the museum, she's also a weaver. And so she brought that whole perspective of being a Diné weaver. And Diné, of course, is the term the Navajo use for themselves. So she's a weaver herself, and she was able to bring in that whole spiritual aspect of Spider Woman and who she is to her as a weaver. Because Spider Woman is there are songs, there are prayers that all are kind of interwoven, I guess, with the weaver's
intended
experience, exactly, when she's weaving a textile. And what's wonderful about this, too, is down in Canyon de Chelly, there's actually a rock formation down in the bottom of the canyon that's supposed to be where Spider Woman came from. And so when you go down, it's called Spider Rock, and it's just a phenomenal kind of formation. It's really beautiful.
And so then when you look at these textiles and baskets, there are these things that look to any casual observer like abstract patterns, but the eight little black squares are the eight legs of the spider.
Exactly. And some scholars refer to these as, and also weavers often refer to these designs as Spider Woman's cross. And, you know, I think a lot of people who don't know a lot about symbolism in the designs would probably look at this as possibly a Christian cross and think, oh, there was some sort of missionary influence or something in the designs. But these designs were done long, 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 long ago. And they're interesting how they have the little spider legs on the edges of the ends of the cross. And also that cross symbol is very much representative of the four cardinal directions also. The other aspect to the designs is the fact that especially with what we call the chief blankets, The designs are very intentional so that when the blankets are actually worn, that the design comes together. For example, if there's a diamond design, only half the design will be on each edge. But when you put it together as a blanket, it forms the full diamond. And it's very, when you think of what goes into the design elements, the aesthetics that is part of this whole process is what's so interesting too, I think.
It's interesting. I remember taking a course in college where they talked about West African symbolism and the symbol of the crossroads and how, mm-hmm. in a way, it made it easier for Christian missionaries to missionize, or whatever you
yes.
call it, because the symbol of the cross already existed. And so it's much easier to get people to believe in your symbolism if they already have some version of it themselves.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think that is also something that when you look at the Catholics, missionaries coming into the Southwest and starting to learn more about the Pueblos, so many of the Catholic religion symbols and feast days, or I guess festivals, kind of fit really well into the Pueblo feast days and so
right.
on.
Right. Yeah. It does seem to be kind of a universal thing.
Right.
So this book, Spider-Woman's Gift, has very beautiful pictures of these weavings, blankets and clothing and baskets. Talk about how the designs reflect and show Navajo ways of thinking and viewing the world.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that really comes through in terms of the textiles, especially the woven woolen textiles, is so many of these designs are carried over from basket designs that were made prior to the actual use of wool to make textiles. One of them certainly is the Spider Woman's cross. And that is, you see that a lot in very early basketry. And those baskets would have been used more for ceremonial purposes than anything else. Then we start to see this kind of a band that's going around baskets. We often refer to these as wedding baskets. That particular design gets carried through on a lot of the dresses. And these dresses are dark woolen dresses with usually a red design across the top. And you see a lot of these, this kind of banded design that has what we would call terraced, kind of a terraced design that could represent clouds, could represent some of the mesas. There's a lot of different interpretations of those designs. The other aspect that you see in these are the you start to see these diamonds develop and trapezoids and all kinds of different elements starting to come through in the design. Some of those are probably designs that they're starting to see in imported goods that are coming in. One of the things that you know, we all know about, of course, is the long walk. And so many of the Diné were removed from their homeland and brought to Bosque Redondo over here in New Mexico. And during that time period, they were with Mescalero Apaches at the same fort. But also there were Americans there. So they're starting to see a lot of American goods coming in, and probably some rugs and some things like that, that they're starting to see some different designs and thinking, well, maybe I could start incorporating some of those designs into my textiles too.
And that was in this ill-fated attempt to turn them into farmers.
Absolutely. And it couldn't have been a worse place, couldn't have been a worse time. They were already practicing agriculture. Out in Canyon de Chelly, they had wonderful orchards that, of course, were burned by the U.S. Army. It's really sad, I think, in terms of our overall history, that this occurred to this group of people. I mean, really sad. But when you look at this rich tradition, especially these weavings, these textiles that grew out of that, because it was really during that time period you start to see a real fluorescence of textiles and their textile designs, especially when they were able to come back to their homeland. And that's when you really see the growth in the sheep. They're starting to do more textiles for trade, especially trade with the Plains Indians. And so there seems to be a real fluorescence of textiles being produced at that time period.
We're talking to Shelby Tisdale, and the book is called Spider Woman's Gift, 19th Century Diné Textiles. Now, it's interesting reading and looking at this because, yeah, they go back to the 19th century and maybe there's some scrap of 18th century material, but it's not like pottery where you can have centuries or millennia worth because these things disintegrate with time. What's the oldest example that you do have?
The oldest example we have is a textile from the 1700s, late 1700s, and this was a blanket, and it's actually, you know, when we look at these textiles, it's so amazing to have something that from that time period that is so well preserved. One of the things that we really focus on in the book is looking at the different styles of the chief blankets. And chief blanket is kind of a overall term we use, but the Navajo themselves, or the Diné, did not have chiefs. And the chief blanket concept came out of the fact that they were trading a lot to tribes that did have chiefs. And the chiefs liked to wear these blankets. They were used as an item of prestige. So with the so-called chief blankets, you get four different phases. They're different styles. They have different looks. And I think in the past, people kind of misinterpreted that as being phases as age phases. You know, as you go from phase one to phase two, it's a different design, a little more complex. That had something to do with age, but it really doesn't. These are all going on almost simultaneously, these different design ideas. And they're beautiful. The first phase are very, very simple in terms of they just have very straight lines. Sometimes they'll have little design elements in the corner. But then with phase two, you start getting these boxes that you get these six boxes around the edges and then one in the center or something like that. And they start to get a little more complex. Then they introduce diamonds. And it all has to do with how the chief or the person is wearing it.
So actually how it hangs on the human body.
That's right. And we have some examples of that in the book as set on mannequins, basically, so we could show how they were actually worn.
Now, talk about the materials and the colors and how those changed over time.
A lot of the material itself, of course, is wool. It would be from the sheep that were grown, or, you know, not grown, but, you know, sheep that were bred, I guess, would be a more appropriate term, by the Navajo themselves. Because when they were returned to their homeland and the reservations were established and so on, they were given sheep. And so they would shear the sheep, they would clean the wool, they would card it, they would hand spin it. And that's the one thing about these textiles are hand spun wool. And there's a real difference between hand-spun wool and commercially made wool. You see more of a kind of a variety in the wool itself. The thickness varies, and the dyes vary also in terms of how they are set into the wool. The other thing is, of course, natural wool. There's the white, there's the brown, and there's the black and the gray. So those would be woven naturally. But then they would use dyes, and they used indigo dyes. The indigo would be, of course, transported in through trade.
That was at some point fairly late in our history. In
yes,
other words, what, late 19th century?
It was pretty much about mid-19th
century
we see indigo.
We just did a show on indigo the other day because of that film.
Oh, that
played
film was
before
wonderful.
Folk art market,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so here we see it traded in about mid-century. Cochineal is being traded in.
And cochineal is made from insects.
That's right. It's these little tiny insects that essentially breed on cactus. And then they they dry them, and then they're brought up as dried insects, and then they would grind the insects up themselves, and that would become the dye. So they used, those two would be the imported dyes, and then they used a lot of natural types of plants for dyes. And one of the plants that they would use would be something like chamisa, and you'd get a nice, almost a green color.
Right.
And you do see some textiles from this time period that have green, which is really interesting. I would say the primary colors are pretty much, you know, the white, black, the indigo, and then just a little bit of the red. Then
and the way they used indigo was very dark. It wasn't some of those bright, rich blues that we think of as indigo.
Right. It's a real dark, dark navy blue almost. What's interesting about the red, they did use cochineal early on, but when they started getting access to wool, especially wool blankets, wool army uniforms, they would start raveling, taking the wool apart and raveling it, and then spinning it and making wool out of it for their textiles.
And that, of course, led to a whole different look, which to textile curators anyway is very distinctive.
It sure is. And they love the red. You start to see more and more of the red incorporated into their textiles as time goes on. Then in about the 1880s, aniline dyes are introduced. That's when you really see a fluorescence of a lot of different colors being introduced into the textiles. And these synthetic dyes or aniline dyes are coming in through the trading posts. And so the weavers all of a sudden have access to a whole range of colors that they never had access before. And you see a lot of that in the serapes.
Right. Serape being the Spanish word.
Right.
What is the influence on how textiles were made by the Spanish and by Americans, how they were made and what they were used for?
Well, one of the real distinctions between Spanish textiles and Diné textiles is the loom itself, because the Navajo or the Diné use an upright loom. And when they're weaving, they don't have any kind of design, you know, that they're following. The designs are all in their head. And the other thing is they can make the loom as wide as they want their textile to be. With the Spanish and the Hispanic weavers here, for example, in New Mexico, they use a floor loom. And on that floor loom, you can only weave a certain width. So when you see Spanish blankets or Hispanic-made blankets here in the Southwest, one of the things that really distinguishes them from Diné textiles is they're usually made with two panels that are then sewn together. And that's something, because oftentimes you'll see similar kinds of blankets with stripes, what we call a moki stripe, and people will mistake those for Diné textiles. And oftentimes, the distinguishing feature is that it's made with the two panels.
Now, when you talk about the loom, something that I thought was interesting also in the book was the loom is not only the vehicle for making the textiles, but also had a kind of symbolism and meaning all of its own.
It really does. Now, Spider Woman's husband, Spider-Man, is the one who created
Spider-Man.
He is the one who actually created the loom and all the different tools. And each tool has a certain name and is put together in a certain way. And when I've worked with Navajo weavers, I went out to the reservation, about 5 or 6 years ago and took an all-week workshop and learned how to weave and learned all the different parts of the loom and all the different tools that you use. And when you're working with the Navajo weaver herself, it's different from my experience, for example. I mean, you can see everything is very intentional. Everything has a certain place, has an order. as to how it's done and how everything is put into place. And it was very interesting to watch that. And you can see it when you look at the loom, the battens, all the different heddles, everything is very specifically placed in order to create that textile. And when I think about it, I think of how complex that is. Other people might think, well, it's fairly simple, but I think it's extremely complex. And when you're trying to weave in those different designs, you have to really know what you're doing, because you have to count your threads in order to have your design to be balanced and so on.
There is somewhere in the book it talks about the spirit line.
Yes.
What is that?
Oftentimes a weaver will leave a line intentionally in the weave that has a little bit of an opening. And they call it a spirit line because it's referring to the fact that if you have that opening, then your spirit is able to escape. It's not captured inside that textile.
Now, whose spirit? The weaver or the person who uses it? Or
the weaver's spirit. And they do the same thing with the basket designs. Especially with the wedding baskets, you'll see there's actually a line break. And that's very intentional for the weaver's spirit to be able to escape. So it's not captured inside that basket.
What happens if their spirit were to be captured inside the basket?
Good question. I probably suspect they wouldn't want to know. But, I mean, that is very much a taboo. And so oftentimes these spirit lines, you'll see those in textiles. Those have often been referred in the literature in the past as lazy lines. Like, as if the weaver wasn't paying attention. But actually they're very intentional. And I think that's what makes them interesting.
That's such a great example of colonialist thinking.
Oh, totally, totally. And I think another thing that, you know, it could have something to do with the weaver signature too. We just don't know enough about, especially in the past, what the intention was.
Well, the idea of the signature, I mean, reading your book, the textiles and the baskets are all anonymous, and I was wondering whether that was an ethic, because individuality and individual production and ego and things like that were frowned upon.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And really, artists didn't really become recognized for their work until about the 1930s. And that was when some of the potters started to sign their pottery. Maria was one
right.
who really started that process. And that had a lot to do with a lot of the people involved in the Indian Arts Fund, for example. They wanted the artist to be known. And this was part of a process that really got started in the 30s. And so prior to that, we don't know a lot about who the artists are. Sometimes we'll get something like a basket or a textile that somewhere along the line we get some documentation, and we can start looking at their basket, for example, and comparing it to the rest of the baskets in the collection. And usually with a basket weaver, you can tell by the start oftentimes that a particular individual will have a certain way of starting their basket.
Uh-huh.
So then if you know a basket weaver starts in a certain way, then you can start looking at your other baskets. Same way with the weaving. I think sometimes there are certain patterns or certain ways of an individual weaver's technique that if you start looking at enough of that particular weaver's work, you can become familiar enough with it, you might be able to recognize something that you don't have a signature for or documentation on.
Exactly. Very interesting. To what extent are the techniques used in the textiles and baskets in this book still being used today?
Yes, they are. Especially in terms of the textiles, a lot of the artists today are using the same techniques. I mean, they're still woven with the upright loom. They are using a lot of the similar kinds of designs that were used in the past. There's almost like a renaissance of weavers going back and shearing their own sheep and carding their own wool and all of that. There was a time period when it would all be sent off and be commercially spun. But there are weavers out on the reservation today still doing everything exactly how it was done in the past.
And is that for the tourist trade? Is that for use at home?
It's for both. And I think part of it is, you know, one, certainly it's to generate income. I mean, they need the income, so it's a part of that process. But also, I think it's a part of carrying on the tradition, because this is an art that's passed from one generation to the next. And you have some artists like D.Y. Begay, who's a contemporary Diné artist in Arizona, who's weaving gorgeous textiles, and sometimes she's weaving in very traditional designs, and other times she's creating her own kind of landscapes in her textiles, but using the same methods, using the same colors, using the same kinds of wool. So I think there are a lot of artists that are still doing it very much in the traditional way, and primarily, I would say, for sale these days.
To what extent are Navajo people and Native people in general getting involved in curatorial and interpretive aspects of the kind of work that you do at the museum?
Well, we were very fortunate at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture that one of our staff members, Joyce Begay Foss, who's our director of education, as I mentioned earlier, she's a weaver also. I had just started at the museum. I think I'd only been there about 6 months, 7 months, and we needed to replace one of the exhibits that we had. And she and I got to talking about possibly doing a textile exhibit, and so she and I worked together on this. And I couldn't have done this exhibit by myself. I really needed her expertise and her experience, and I think she brought that to the exhibit that did, probably just from a mainstream curatorial perspective, I would not have brought that same kind of idea to the exhibit.
Shelby Tisdale is the director of the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, Laboratory of Anthropology, the editor of the new book Spider Woman's Gift, 19th Century Diné Textiles, and once again there will be a discussion and book signing this Sunday, the 24th of July at 2 o'clock at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. The event is free with museum admission, and Sundays are always free to New Mexico residents. For more information, indianartsandculture.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Wonderful to see you, Mary Charlotte.
Likewise. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.